From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
America first, on the world stage. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point. In his first address to the UN General Assembly today, President Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea, calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man on a suicide mission. He told an audience of world leaders that Iran is a murderous regime and that the nuclear deal is an embarrassment to the United States. While saying that some countries around the world are going to hell, he also called for standing together with the U.S. and every other nation, putting its own interests first. All this with cutbacks curtailing State Department diplomacy. Is the Trump administration giving up leadership of the Western world? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. President Trump played good cop, bad cop today in his first address to the United Nations General Assembly. He told world leaders the U.S. is ready to destroy another country, North Korea, while saying that nations should work together, although each in its own self-interest. We'll hear much more. But first, this news update, a new development in the investigation of possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. CNN reports that former campaign chair Paul Manafort was wiretapped by the FBI under secret court orders before and after the election. Evan Perez is an investigative reporter for CNN. Evan, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Tell us what it takes to get this kind of a warrant.
Well, it takes a lot. This is a particularly intrusive type of warrant, and because of that, certainly before you're able to use that with a U.S. citizen, there's a lot the FBI has to do to persuade judges on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And, you know, they have to get, first of all, they have to get approval from the highest levels of the Justice Department and the FBI, and they have to put together essentially a declaration and paperwork to show that they believe whoever they're trying to wiretap was acting as an agent of a foreign government, and that they were doing so knowingly. So all of that they have to be able to prove, they have to be able to say what the suspicion is and the reason for them to be able to do this type of intrusive surveillance of an American citizen. And keep in mind, a lot of this is done in 90-day rolling periods, so they have to come back and get approval every time, every 90 days, to be able to get to be able to do this type of surveillance.
So they have to persuade the judge there was probable cause that an important crime of an international nature might have been committed.
Well, yeah, the standard that they have to meet is not exactly probable cause, but they certainly have to show that they have reasonable suspicion, and they have to be able to show a judge why they believe that. They have to have additional evidence or intelligence that might indicate why they're doing this.
President Trump has complained that President Obama tapped his wires. Does this appear to be the case? Was this during the time that James Comey was the director of the FBI?
Right. This would have been during the time that that Comey was the FBI director. And look, I think a lot of the internet and Twitter in particular have sort of gone on fire because they believe that the reporting we produced yesterday proves that the president in the end was right. I don't think it does. The president made a specific allegation. He said in his tweet that Obama had his wires tapped. That's not how this works. This is something that the FBI does. Generally, they don't even brief the White House, so it's not even clear that the president would, President Obama would have been informed of this. And President Obama doesn't order wiretaps. It doesn't work that way.
Okay.
President Trump wouldn't be able to do this. There's a separation of the way this works with the FBI. So the president's tweet, I think, remains without any basis or any support. The Justice Department, by the way, has said that there's no support, no evidence to support what the president tweeted. And as recently as last week, the Justice Department has said in court the same thing, and they've said, you know, they can't confirm or deny whether or not there were any FISA warrants.
Is it likely that Manafort, who was the subject of the wiretap, was talking to President Trump or to candidate Trump at least some point during these conversations?
I think it's very likely. The FBI was on his phones, and we know that the president and Manafort were communicating well into this year, even past the election, even after the time that Manafort resigned or was ousted as chairman of the campaign. If you remember, that happened last August. So we know that President Trump has a habit of, when he fires someone, he keeps reaching out to them and keeps trying to, you know, cultivate them, I suppose. And so it's very likely that he would have been captured on some of these wiretaps. The problem is, or the question is, what happened with those wiretaps, whether or not those exist somewhere. The way this works with the FBI is that you're supposed to sort of excise that and remove that unless there's some reason why you should be able to get it, and you have to get permission from a judge to do that.
So you said there's this 90-day period, and it's been on again, off again. If it started with James Comey as head of the FBI, has it continued with Robert Mueller, who has access to the FBI, as the special prosecutor?
We don't know whether or not it is still ongoing. We know that it was ongoing into early this year. And obviously the investigation and the fact that Manafort and it has been a focus of this investigation has been in the news, and as time goes on, I imagine that you'd find less use from doing wiretap of somebody like that, because they know that they're being listened to, or they know that they're being watched. So it's not clear to me that it has continued into this year. And keep in mind, the first part of this wiretapping began under an earlier investigation of Manafort, because he worked with a former ruling party in Ukraine.
Okay.
And the FBI was interested to see whether or not there was anything there that they needed to know about with his relationship with that former party in Ukraine.
All right. And the New York Times is reporting today, or reported yesterday, that in the recent investigation of Manafort, when they actually went to his house, they picked the lock while he was asleep. They told him that he might be indicted. Evan Perez, again, is with the CNN, covers the Justice Department for them, and thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, America First on the world stage. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. As other world leaders took their turns today, President Trump made his first address to the UN General Assembly. He threatened what he called small regimes that violate UN principles.
If the righteous many do not confront the wicked few, then evil will triumph.
His main target, North Korea, which has been testing ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Rocket Man, his term for Kim Jong-un, leader of North Korea. Samini Sengupta is covering the United Nations for the New York Times. She's been there for a while. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Warren. Good to be with you.
Has this ever happened before? Has a president of the United States, the so-called leader of the world, free world, most powerful nation on earth, threatened to destroy another nation in that forum?
It is certainly a very unusual statement, but the entire speech was very unusual for an American president to make. It was very high on nationalist sentiments. He used the word sovereign or sovereignty 21 times in his speech. It was, as you've pointed out, very plainly bellicose, threatening to totally destroy North Korea, in his words, calling Iran a rogue nation and suggesting that he might withdraw from what he called an embarrassment, the Iranian nuclear deal, and on Venezuela, suggesting that his administration was, quote, prepared to take further action. But on none of those things did he come out with any specific things that he was going to do. But it was certainly a very, very remarkable speech, particularly for an American president.
Once again, the use of the word sovereignty 21 times. Here's the way he summed that up.
As president of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
So, Samini Sengupta, how did we heard a little bit of clapping there at the end of that comment, but how did the body, the world leaders that are gathered today, although not all of them by any means, not the leader of China, not the leader of Russia, how did they respond?
Well, to my great dismay, I did not see who were the ones clapping to that phrase, because those who are fond of appealing to sovereignty, of course, are countries like China, Venezuela, Syria often. So this is not, sovereignty is not a new argument to be making at the United Nations. It's relatively unusual for the United States to make it, because the United States, at the United Nations, its sovereignty is by no means threatened. Remember, the U.S. is a veto-wielding member of the Security Council. So as a regular matter, it acts in its own interest and in the interests of its allies. That's how diplomacy works here. So the appeals to sovereignty were certainly worth noting here.
What about the American delegation, which, as I understand it, has been much reduced from prior years, with Secretary Tillerson cutting down the State Department in general and not appointing a lot of high-level positions?
That's right. I mean, the American delegation was had a light footprint, if you will, given Secretary Tillerson's cuts to the State Department staff that came along. However, it's worth noting that Secretary Tillerson was very much here. Of course, President Trump's envoy to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, who is arguably his most prominent diplomat to the world these days. She was here. General McMaster was here, as was the chief of staff, Mr. Kelly, and they all came to the lunch with world leaders, where I just was. Reporters are allowed to be there for the first few minutes to see who's shaking hands with whom and who sits where. We noted that on the menu, the first item on the menu was a wild rocket salad. But of course, the man referred to as Rocket Man was not in attendance.
Wasn't Kim Chi. So I take it that when the president made his toast and held up a glass of wine, even though he doesn't drink wine, he was not applauded.
Well, he was certainly not. There wasn't really applause in that particular venue. But as you pointed out, his speech in the main hall did get some applause at key moments. It should be pointed out that in addition to what he said, it's notable what he did not say. There was hardly a word on Russia, though there were, you know, lots of broadsides against the Kremlin's allies, Venezuela, Syria, etc. And there was absolutely no mention of the Paris Agreement or climate change. And mind you, the Secretary General, who spoke just before, indeed two speakers before, the Secretary General made it very clear that the Paris Agreement was absolutely worth stepping on, stepping up ambitions on. He also called the science of climate change unassailable. And later in the morning, when the French President Macron spoke, he said about climate, he said, quote, the planet will not negotiate with us. And that was a very clear response to Mr. Trump's speech.
And he said that Macron, would not stand for renegotiation of the Paris Agreement. Samini Sen Gupta, I know you're extremely busy at the United Nations. You're very kind to join us. And thanks a lot, once again, covering the UN for the New York Times. Great to have you.
Thanks.
Let me introduce Brett Schaefer. He's a senior research fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much.
What did you hear in the president's speech that you think should have been applauded?
Well, I think that the president made very clear that he has some priorities that he considers to be not only concerns for the United States, but for the world at large. Most prominently, North Korea's pursuit of ballistic missiles capable of delivering nuclear weapons to the United States and to many other countries. Iran's capability of pursuing nuclear weapons, even within the terms of the Iran nuclear deal. The disregard for many countries for human rights practices in the Human Rights Council, and also disregard for the rights of their own citizens and their repressive actions. And so I thought this was a very interesting speech to bring forward a number of different concerns that the president has and that the United States has, and to challenge the membership to be more assertive in addressing them.
What about the president of the United States in that forum threatening to destroy another country?
Well, when you take a look at the context of that, it is when North Korea, if it attacks or threatens the U.S. or its allies, then the United States will have no response, have no choice but to destroy North Korea. So this is, when you take a look at the comments themselves or the sentence structure itself, it's just a restatement of U.S. policy that if we're attacked, we will respond with overwhelming force, which is longstanding U.S. policy. And along those lines, I thought that the president, this is where I think he failed or perhaps underserved the content of the speech, was in his delivery. I listened to the speech, and like everybody else, I was caught up in various highlights that the president made. But in reading the speech itself, I thought it was actually a very interesting and thoughtful explication of the president's foreign policy perspectives. And I would urge the listeners to take the 10 minutes of time to read the speech, because I think just by looking at the clips or hearing the highlights of it, you're not getting a full appreciation for his worldview and the challenges that he laid before the other member states. And I have to wonder whether as an English speaker, you're actually not appreciating the full impact of the speech on the audience before him, many of whom are going to hear it through a translator.
Brett Schaefer, once again, at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. Nicholas Burns joined us. He is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. He was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs during the George W. Bush administration. He's now a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What do you think of this speech today, particularly the threat against North Korea? Is that just simply a restatement of longstanding U.S. policy, or is it something more?
Well, on the North Korea part of the speech, the president obviously is right to say, to take the position that if the United States is attacked, or Japan or South Korea, or American forces in Asia, we will, of course, defend ourselves. That's the key to strategic deterrence,
sure,
what every president since Eisenhower has said. But I thought this was an unfortunate tone, an unfortunate choice of words. The president today was nothing like Ronald Reagan would have been. Reagan would have been steely, determined, but he wouldn't have gotten down the mosh pit of international politics and traded insults with Kim Jong-un. He would have been above it and more self-confident. And the president today was bombastic. And you don't want to give a propaganda advantage to a two-bit dictator like Kim Jong-un. But if the United States president sounds as if he is looking for war, and he didn't talk about diplomacy today, then I think we've got a problem selling this and having it understood in many parts of the world, particularly in South Korea, where the population is very frightened at the prospect of a conflict. So I didn't think the president did well at all today in delivering this very important message.
So you not only criticize his delivery, but also the speech itself. We heard from Brick Schaefer that if you actually read the speech, it's pretty well put together and a very good statement of American policy.
Well, it's not. The America First policy of President Trump turns Republican orthodoxy of the last 70 years completely on its head. There's nothing in here about alliances and partnerships. There's no support for free trade. There's no support for what Republicans have always supported since the Second World War, as well as Democrats, and that's immigration and refugees, that we should be a big country, that at a time of the greatest crisis, refugee crisis since 1945, our answer is that we don't close our doors the way President Trump is. So I think America First appeals to the nativist, isolationist part of our DNA. We've seen it in the 1930s. We saw it in the 1840s and 50s with the Know-Nothings who protested the immigration of Catholics into the United States from Ireland and Italy. And it's mean-spirited. It's never worked for America. It won't work for us in 2017. And President Trump is deviating from every president since the 1940s
All
on
right.
these
we,
issues.
We've heard a very serious disagreement between the two of you with regard to the speech itself. Let's go to one of the specifics, and that has to do, once again, with the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me.
Brett Schaefer, back to you with the Heritage Foundation. Does this suggest that the president wants to rip it up?
I think he's challenging the membership to actually get a deal that we can actually hold Iran to. Right now, we don't have the ability or access to Iran to do inspections on military sites. We don't have the anywhere, anytime inspection capability that President Obama promised would be the case. And right now, frankly, Iran has violated some terms of the agreement and also pursued ballistic missile technology in violation of other UN Security Council resolutions, continues to support terrorist groups like Hezbollah, and is a destabilizing agent in the Middle East. And so I think the president is right to identify Iran in the terms that he outlined here, and to challenge the membership to actually get an agreement that can be abided by and that can we can be assured that Iran is actually not pursuing nuclear weapons, as is the goal of that very agreement.
Ambassador Burns, do you agree that, in fact, Iran is violating the agreement and that the promises made by President Obama simply are not being kept?
No, it's not true that Iran has not violated this narrower agreement that President Obama and five other countries negotiated in 2015. In fact, the International Atomic Energy Agency has said very recently that Iran is abiding by it. That was a difficult deal. I supported it, but obviously it's not a perfect deal. If we walked away from it now, Warren, no one else would walk out with us. The British wouldn't, the Germans wouldn't, the French, and certainly not the Russians and Chinese. Iran would get away. They'd have sanctions relief, and then all the limits that were put on their nuclear program would be taken off. So it's a no-win for the United States to walk away. Where President Trump, I thought, was good today, where he made, I think, strong points, Iran has been the great aggressor in the Middle East. It's stoking violence in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. It's a real threat to the Sunni world. And I think if President Obama focused his attention on Iran's regional posture, he'd have a lot of support from the Sunni Arab world, from many Europeans, and I think from both Republicans and Democrats, not all, but many Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill. And I certainly think he was right to call out Iran on its destructive policies in the region. But you've got to be careful to distinguish between these two issues, because whereas I agree that Iran's testing of ballistic missiles is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions, it's not a violation of the narrow nuclear agreement.
All right. Former UN ambassador, U.S. ambassador to NATO, Nicholas Burns. He was with the George W. Bush administration. Bert Schaefer with the Heritage Foundation. We'll be back with them. We'll also talk with John Park of the Korea Working Group about the threat to North Korea. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. We've heard today that in his first address to the U.N. General Assembly, President Trump had very hostile words, as expected, for North Korea, saying, again, it's been policy since the Eisenhower administration that we would destroy that country if, in fact, it attacked us, language, however, being questioned. He also said, however, that the United States would act in its own interests at all times. But then he said this.
We want harmony and friendship, not conflict and strife. We are guided by outcomes, not ideology. We have a policy of principled realism rooted in shared goals, interests, and values.
John Park is director of the Korea Working Group at the Harvard Kennedy School. Good to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
I guess the country we want to talk about for a moment is not North Korea, but South Korea. How are they, do you think, responding to what we heard today from the president and what we've heard leading up to this moment?
Well, Warren, this is Unga. This is the meeting of the U.N. General Assembly. So the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, is in Manhattan, and they are scheduled to meet in a trilateral setting with Prime Minister Abe of Japan as well. So you can be sure that President Moon is going to be asking a lot of clarifying questions. We saw the reference to Kim Jong-un as Rocket Man in this official speech, and also something of a very clear ultimatum. The only acceptable future is for North Korea to denuclearize. So these are the types of statements from a South Korean perspective. It's very much of the concern that this is out of control in terms of a U.S.-South Korea approach to dealing with North Korea, which is the traditional approach that we've seen, one where the United States is saying things that definitely are a few steps ahead of what the South Koreans are prepared to deal with and what they can wrap their heads around in terms of what has just been stated this morning.
Should it be a surprise to South Korea that the United States would say that if we are attacked by North Korea, then we will destroy that country?
Absolutely. Recently, President Moon stated that he would not allow war to happen on the Korean Peninsula. And he stated that through the context of the U.S.-South Korea alliance, where the use of force has to be a consensus between the United States and the South Koreans. But this is a different formulation, and I think this goes back to the events of what happened in July of this past year. On July 4th, the North Koreans conducted their first intercontinental ballistic missile. That one was determined to be able to range Alaska. The second ICBM test happened a few weeks later, July 28th. That particular ICBM was estimated to have the range of the continental United States. And then recently we had the sixth nuclear test where the North Koreans essentially conducted a man-made earthquake that registered 6.3 on the Richter scale. So North Korea is now viewed as a clear and present danger to the United States for those in the national security team in Washington. And that's the part that I don't think the South Korean side is fully grasping.
Why aren't they fully grasping it? They're the ones who are in the immediate line of fire with the city of Seoul, many millions of people just 35 or 40 miles from the artillery that's pointed at it.
Well, I've heard a lot of commentary and read a lot about South Koreans somehow being delusional or not fully understanding the stakes. I think another interpretation is it's the type of South Korean, I should say, resiliency. The fact that they've been confronting this type of danger for decades now, and they're able to go about their daily lives and function normally. But there is now a calculus that is different, and the broader South Korean population is dealing with North Korea as the devil they know. They're accustomed to these types of actions, and they feel that there is a certain type of logic and understanding of why North Korea would do what it's doing. They may not agree with it, but they understand the logic. The broader South Korean population, though, does not understand Washington. There's still confusion of whether it's General Mattis that's setting policy as it relates to North Korea or President Trump. And to have a core ally like South Korea confused, that is not a good thing.
Well, Mattis, as I understand it, has said pretty much the same thing that the president said today, although he's not the president, didn't say it in the General Assembly. But are you suggesting that it's just simply time to recognize that North Korea is, in fact, a nuclear power? It's going to have to be dealt with as a nuclear power. rather than in a diplomatic way, as, of course, it has demanded all these years, claiming that it is doing this for defensive reasons and pointing to what happened to other leaders, Mr. Gaddafi and the former leader of Iraq, when they gave up their nuclear weapons.
Well, Warren, there is a bit of a departure, and I don't want to get too dramatic, but because of what we just heard this morning, before, the unspoken reality was this idea that in 6 to 8 months' time, we would either learn to live with a nuclear ICBM North Korea that we would then be able to deter and contain, or we would seek and see some sort of military solution. It was going to be one or the two. But this morning, the formulation is more along the lines of an ultimatum, that the only acceptable future is for North Korea to denuclearize. So with that, I think we're seeing the beginnings of a departure of the other view that we can somehow get over the psychological hump of a millennial with a nuclear ICBM and learn how to deal and contain and deter that individual in that country and that regime, to now where there is something of the visualization of a closing window. And if North Korea doesn't commit to denuclearization as this window or stop this window from closing, there will be repercussions.
John Park with the Korea Working Group at the Harvard Kennedy School. Back to Brett Schaefer with the Heritage Foundation. What do you say to this idea that the ultimatum that we heard today narrows the options for dealing with North Korea? It either has to denuclearize or get attacked.
Well, I think it's better. To go back to the very formulation of the statement that the president made in the speech today at the UN, the statement says that if the United States is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. So the question is, the statement very clearly says that it's not a provocative or an assertive action by the United States, but that it would be done in response to a direct threat to the United States. So I think that context is clear from the speech itself, though it may not have been clear from the way the president presented it.
Let me go back to Nicholas Burns, again, formerly with the George W. Bush administration as a very top diplomat. What do you say to the idea that this was an ultimatum and that it does narrow the options?
Well, I don't think it narrows the options, mainly because, as John Park has said, you do have other American officials out there, Secretary Mattis, Secretary Tillerson, clearly saying the same thing. We'll defend ourselves, which is the better way to put it, and actually the stronger way to put it, if necessary. But ultimately, I think this administration is trying to get to the negotiating table. There isn't a quick fix. There's no easy solution. Maybe the best we can do with the help of China and other countries is to convince the North Koreans to freeze their program. This is really heading towards diplomacy, and our military continues to say at the top levels, there's no military solution here. What you don't want in a conflict like this, Warren, is to have multiple voices with different messages from Washington. And President Trump today, his rhetoric did not match Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson, who've been much more sophisticated in what they've said. Kim Jong-un is isolated. He's not very sophisticated in terms of his understanding about the world. You want to give him a clear message, a tough message, but you don't want to give him one that's garbled. And I think that's another error that the president made in his tactics today.
Let's go back and hear one more excerpt from the president's address today. Once again, his first to the world leaders assembled at the General Assembly of the United Nations.
If it could actually accomplish all of its stated goals, especially the goal of peace, this investment would easily be well worth it. Major portions of the world are in conflict, and some, in fact, are going to hell. But the powerful people in this room, under the guidance and auspices of the United Nations, can solve many of these vicious and complex problems.
That's the president after saying that the United States pays 22% of the budget, which he referred to as an unfair cost burden. Then he said what we just did, and once again at the luncheon, which we heard about from Somini Sengupta, he said that the United States does have a lot of potential. Nicholas Burns, back to you. Your take on this view of the United Nations as opposed to compared to the United States, and is the amount of money that we're now spending, as the president suggests, not worth it?
Well, the United Nations is highly imperfect. It's a bloated bureaucracy. It can't resolve a lot of problems on its own, but it was our idea, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt's. It's in our largest and most important city. We have tremendous influence there. On issues like climate change, it can be the place where the world unites to do something positive on climate change. On issues like caring for refugees or conflict prevention, the UN can be helpful on the margins to the United States. So no American president since FDR has walked away from the United Nations. I don't think President Trump's going to do that. But I think if he's careful and skillful, he could use the United Nations and work with it to the advantage of the United States. And I think, Warren, my last point here, the America First message today is a narrow isolationist message. It's as almost as if President Trump is saying, by emphasizing sovereignty, I'll take care of my country, you take care of yours. That's an 1817 way of looking at the world. We live in a highly integrated global economy. We've got to be out working with countries and leading. That's what Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush did so successfully at the end of the Cold War. They said to the rest of the world, we are with you and we'll lead. And that isn't the message that President Trump is giving. And I think that's a shame that he's turning his back on what made us great in foreign policy.
Brett Schaefer with the Heritage Foundation. What's your take on that?
Well, I absolutely agree with Mr. Burns that the UN is an imperfect institution, but it can be useful at times. But at the same time, while we were instrumental in founding the organization, it's certainly not atypical of the United States to expect more and demand more of that organization. We are the largest financial contributor to the UN, and we should, as responsible stewards of American taxpayer dollars, expect that those dollars and our contributions to the organization be spent well and effectively.
Well, what more should we demand? What should it do that it's not doing now?
Well, sure. The UN, for instance, is not holding accountable those members of its organization, whether they be peacekeepers or UN employees who are committing crimes such as sexual exploitation and abuse. The Secretary General himself has announced a new plan to hold those committing such crimes to account, and the U.S. is supporting that. The Secretary General and the United States are working together to try and eliminate duplicative or outdated activities that the U.N. is currently funding to make sure that the resources that we do provide are applied in ways that address the problems of today and not those of yesterday. There are many mandates in the organization, mandates being activities that date back to the very founding of the organization that consume time and resources and man hours that just simply do not need to be applied today in any useful way. There's management systems inside the organization that frankly waste millions of dollars. Updating those management systems and software and reporting and accounting can actually eliminate the need for a number of people in the organization that frankly just push paper around. And finally, there's a number of people based in New York and Geneva and other high-cost areas that should be instead placed in the field where they can be more directly applying the goals of the organization to the populations that they're designed to serve instead of being located in essentially UN headquarters at high cost to very little purpose.
Nicholas Burns, back to you. You were not ambassador to the UN, but you were ambassador to NATO, and you were U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs during the George W. Bush administration. You're a career diplomat. What do you say to what you've been hearing? And comment, if you will, on the fact that Secretary Tillerson has so drastically reduced the delegation that the United States has sent to the UN and also the manpower or human power of the Department of State itself.
Well, I think Brett makes some very good points that this is an institution, the United Nations, that needs to be reformed. And President Trump, I thought, made some fair points yesterday when he had his reform meeting with the UN leaders. On the State Department, what's missing from the president's presentation of American power is diplomacy, which is a major part of what we do around the world. We've got to have a strong military, a strong intelligence community, but we want strong diplomats. The Trump administration is asking for a 31% budget cut in the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development, which would be catastrophic. And it's interesting, Warren, to see Republicans on Capitol Hill pushing back, as well as Democrats, saying we've got to fully fund the State Department at a time like this, because eventually
the North Korea crisis is going to end up at a negotiating table. The Syrian civil war is going to end up at a negotiating table. Our ability to be effective on climate change is all about diplomacy. And if you, a 31% budget cut might mean that we'd have to lay off 2,000 American diplomats. So the president's evocation of American power is about hard power, about the military. That's not how our generals see it. They're the biggest supporters of American diplomacy. And I hope we'll see Secretary Tillerson be more forceful in standing up for the department. You know, most of the senior ranks of the State Department are still not filled out 9 months, almost 10 months into the administration. We don't have an ambassador in South Korea yet. We don't have an ambassador in most of the countries of the world. And so it's the State Department's been hollowed out. We're a great global power. We need the State Department to be fully functioning.
Still with us, John Park, director of the Korea Working Group at the Harvard Kennedy School. What about the fact that there's no ambassador yet in South Korea? Is that important? Are you concerned about the reduction of the number of diplomats who are now working for the Tillerson State Department?
I share Professor Burns' concern. You have to have people. You have to have the team members here. But with respect to your earlier question, all these things are relative. If you look at Tokyo and Beijing, they have ambassadors now in place. South Korea does not, and that speaks volumes. So when you're looking at that type of essentially appointments and having those individuals on the ground and with their specific backgrounds as well in terms of proximity to the president, this is where South Korea definitely feels like the odd person out here.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for being on our program today. This is To the Point from PRI. In a moment, Republicans in the Senate take one more shot at Obamacare. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Alney here with today's Talking Point. It looks like a familiar scenario. There's a lot of talk on Capitol Hill today, in the U.S. Senate in particular, with Republicans taking one more shot at Obamacare. But the latest bill by Senators Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy is not the same as the one defeated when John McCain dramatically turned his thumb down in the early hours one recent morning. Here is Graham explaining the idea of funding Medicaid with block grants to the states.
Should some bureaucrat you'll never meet in Washington be in charge of your health care, or should somebody that you actually know and vote for be in charge of your health care? The block grant has a beautiful concept to it. The people we empower, you actually live with them and you vote for them.
But the Liberal Democrat Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts says this is nothing new.
It's just another version of the same old cruel, heartless, shameless plan that Republicans have spent the last 8 months trying to jam down the throats of the American people.
Dylan Scott covers healthcare for Vox. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So they've got until, what is it, Saturday of next week before they run out of opportunities to do this without needing a two-thirds vote in the Senate, which would be subject to a filibuster.
Yes, that's right. For complex reasons that we don't have to get into, the special procedure that Republicans are using to advance the bill with only 51 votes, the authority for that expires on September 30th. So they're working under a deadline, and I think it's pretty clear that that deadline is what's motivating a lot of this action that we've seen over the last few days.
Are they all the Republicans, that is, going to be willing to take the risk of making it their health care plan, whether it involves Medicaid or something else, which this would undoubtedly do and which the president has been demanding they do? That's politically pretty difficult, given what it would mean for people with health insurance.
Yeah, that's true. We haven't seen a kind of final analysis of the Graham-Cassidy bill, but it seems safe to project that it would reduce health care spending and would therefore lead to fewer people having health insurance. And obviously that has been the problem that has stopped some of the previous plans that Republicans have come up with to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. I think kind of the important underlying reality to understand is there are 52 Senate Republicans. 45 of them or so would probably vote for literally any plan you put forward that you call Obamacare repeal. And the real key is that those half dozen or so other Senate Republicans who have wavered a little bit over the last few months. And so it's really going to come down to a couple of members and whether they decide that this is the Obamacare repeal plan that they can support.
And, of course, the Speaker, Paul Ryan, says that the House will, in fact, vote to approve this bill if, in fact, the Senate does. You talked about final analysis. That involves the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, which we haven't heard from yet. John McCain indicated that he wasn't happy about the fact that they were pushing through the last one so fast without there being CBO analysis and hearings. They're not going to have any hearings on this.
Right. So, yeah, John McCain is one of those key members to watch for that very reason. He's been very outspoken about how much he dislikes the process. To your point, the CBO has said that they should be able to get the Senate some really basic information just to make sure that the bill complies with the Senate's budget rules, but they aren't going to be able to give us a final analysis on how many people are going to have health insurance, what's going to happen to premiums, some of that pretty rudimentary information that people, I think, expect when they're evaluating a health care bill. To one of your other points, they have announced here in the last couple of days that one of the Senate committees will hold a hearing on the Graham-Cassidy bill next week. But that is, I mean, to be frank, it's become pretty transparent that those hearings are being convened explicitly to try to assuage the concerns of John McCain and a few other people who have said that they don't like the process that's produced this bill.
Go ahead.
So whether it does, McCain has been pretty inscrutable here for the last few days. But that's clearly the attempt that they're trying to make to give him a fig leaf of, here, we held a hearing, now you can kind of retire your complaints about regular order.
We also have other senators who are crucial to this. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Susan Collins of Maine, Rand Paul of Kentucky. They all did not vote for the last one. Maybe Rand Paul did. I'm sorry, I can't remember. But they need three. And here are four altogether with John McCain. We've talked about him. What about the others?
Yeah, so I think, you know, nothing is certain until the bill goes on the Senate floor. But at this point, Rand Paul and Susan Collins have made pretty clear that they don't think they can support this bill for very different reasons. Paul doesn't think that it does nearly enough to repeal Obamacare. Collins is worried about the cuts to Medicaid and the other federal funding cuts and what that would mean for health coverage. But they've been pretty explicit that they're not going to be able to vote for this bill. And so when you go back to that basic math of there are 52 Senate Republicans and 50 of them need to vote for something for it to pass, to your point, that leaves just basically Lisa Murkowski and John McCain hold the fate of this bill in their hands. And McCain has not at all made clear whether or not his concerns about process have been answered. And as for Lisa Murkowski, she has been inscrutable kind of throughout the healthcare debate. The one thing I guess to remember is she has voted against every Obamacare repeal plan that's come up on the Senate floor thus far. They voted on three of them in late July. And so she would have to decide that this Graham-Cassidy bill is the Obamacare repeal bill that she can finally support. For the time being, she's just said that she's looking at the numbers for Alaska, the way that the bill is put together. Different states are going to see very different effects. And so I think we just don't know yet. All we know is she has a track record of opposing the repeal bills that Republicans have put forward so far. But for now, she's kind of resorting to a kind of rote answer about waiting to see how the numbers work out for Alaska.
Speaking of numbers, very few people in Alaska, and they're spread all over the place, and there is much concern about the availability of health care and support, of course, for many people who live in very isolated ways. If this bill were to get to the Senate, it's my understanding that debate might be limited to 90 seconds?
Yeah, so this is a little wonky, but basically the way it would technically work is the Senate would resume the debate that it started in late July when they had a series of votes on a different Obamacare repeal proposals. And because in late July they used up all of the debate time that was allotted for this special budget reconciliation procedure, the way it works out is that there's really only, as you say, as little as 90 seconds of debate left. Now, they would still have a series of votes on amendments to the bill, what's known as Votorama, so it's not as if there would be debate would start and 90 seconds later there would be a vote on final passage. But given all the concerns that have been raised about process and this bill being developed behind closed doors and et cetera and so forth, there is a certain richness to the idea that we could only have 90 minutes on the Senate floor to debate it.
You've said this is wonky a number of times, and it is, and yet there's no other way to talk about it at this point because we've got down to wonky. That's what's left, it seems to me, between making a decision on this thing or not making a decision on this. I love the idea of a Votorama.
Yeah, and I do think, and though it's funny in a way because it is all very wonky, especially the way that the Senate works and the particulars of the bill. But I think the underlying reality here is Republicans are staring at a September 30th deadline, and they know that after that day, it'll be almost impossible for them to repeal Obamacare, which they promised for 7 years that they would do. And so in a lot of ways, despite all the granular nature of the policy and the wonky Senate procedures, I think a lot of them are coming back to that fundamental fact. Either we can repeal Obamacare or we can leave it in place. And that's what's motivating a lot of the momentum here, and the details are kind of being cast aside.
If the Republicans can't do this by the end of next week, does that mean we're then going to be talking about Bernie Sanders and his proposal of Medicare for all? We heard a moment ago Elizabeth Warren, she supports it, so do a lot of others.
Sure, I do think, and Republicans are seizing that argument. They are, the press conference this afternoon, Lindsey Graham, one of the sponsors of the bill, said it was sort of a stark choice between either federalism under the Republican plan or socialism under the Bernie Sanders Medicare for All plan. So they're certainly using it as an opportunity to say either we pass our Obamacare repeal health care plan now, or we're going to turn towards something that looks like single payer. I'm sure the truth would be more complicated than that, but that's the choice that Republicans are trying to present here at the end.
All right. Socialism was the charge against Medicare before it was passed. Obviously, everybody loves Medicare, and there are those who deny that it is not just socialism, but that it's not even single payer. There still might be insurance companies in and around the area. It's a very complicated situation, and at the moment we're looking at this last-ditch effort. Hail Mary is what Chuck Schumer calls it by the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, this plan, Republicans were not working on this plan for all the months that they were, that they had been debating health care over the summer. This really did pop up just here at the end because we've got that deadline facing us.
Dylan Scott with Vox, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.